This episode is brought to you by Buffalo Trace Distillery. Powerful yet smooth. Contained but never tame. Proudly going their own way, but never going alone. This is the spirit inside Buffalo Trace Bourbon. Made at Buffalo Trace Distillery, the world's most award-winning distillery. Buffalo Trace is always perfectly untamed. Distilled, aged, and bottled by Buffalo Trace Distillery, Franklin County, Kentucky. 90 proof, 45% alcohol by volume. Learn more at buffalotracedistillery.com. Please drink responsibly.
This episode is brought to you by Hotels.com. When I went on my last holiday to Cape Town, it was amazing. My friends were there, the weather was phenomenal, and most importantly, the food was fantastic. But one thing I struggled with was finding the right places to stay. You know, all I want is a great bed, a fantastic shower, and breakfast that doesn't end at 8 a.m. I'm on holiday, I'm still sleeping. I also like ease, and the Hotels.com app easily helps me to find a perfect hotel for every trip. Whether you're looking for a family-friendly getaway or a relaxing spa weekend, on the Hotels.com app, you can compare up to 5 hotels side by side. Now, why would you want to do that? So you can see prices, amenities, and star ratings. And best of all, you don't have to switch back and forth between options. See? Ease. So, start planning your next getaway and find your perfect somewhere in the Hotels.com app today.
Buzz around artificial intelligence is seemingly everywhere. Is your portfolio keeping up? Consider the Global X Artificial Intelligence and Technology ETF, ticker AIQ, which invests in dozens of stocks at the leading edge of this disruption. Investing involves risk, including possible loss of principal. Technology companies can be affected by rapid product obsolescence and intense industry competition. Before investing, carefully consider the fund's objectives, risks, charges, expenses, and more in the full or summary prospectus at globalxetfs.com. Read carefully. Distributed by SEI Investments Distribution Co.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Latin American Studies. I'm Bryce Bongiovanni, your host. And today, my guest is Eric Ching. Ching is a professor at Furman University and the author of Authoritarian El Salvador, Politics and the Origins of the Military Regimes, 1880 to 1940. Ching examines the history of patronage systems and authoritarianism in El Salvador and their relationship to rhetoric of democracy and suffrage during the period leading up to the coup of 1931 and the peasant revolt and repression of 1932.
Thanks, Bryce. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
All right. Well, to start off with, can you tell us a little bit about how you came to this subject? What in your academic career brought you to working on El Salvador?
Sure. As you said, I'm a professor here at Furman University, which is here in Greenville, South Carolina, in the upstate of South Carolina, not too far from where you're at right now in Macon, Georgia. Mm-hmm. And, Furman has been a wonderful place to work, and I've really found a home here in Greenville, South Carolina, which is a very nice place to live, but I hadn't stepped foot in the South before I came here to interview for this job in 1998. And so this has become kind of an adopted home for me, an adopted professional life, and that seems to be a recurrent theme in my life because I also don't have any particular organic connection to El Salvador. Hmm. And so I guess the shortest answer to how I came to be a Salvadoranist and to devote my professional life to El Salvador would be that it is based in political consciousness raising in the 1980s. Hmm. I grew up and was born and raised in the Midwest in a particularly, Midwestern WASPy environment. So even though my last name sounds Chinese, it's not. It's actually English. My dad's side of the family is English and my mom's side is Norwegian, and Ching comes from a little suburb outside of London called Chingford. So, I grew up in a, like I say, you know, pretty Midwestern WASPy environment. And I actually have very powerfully distinct recollection of Ronald Reagan's address to the nation in 1984 on Central America, in which he was, you know, sitting in the Oval Office or wherever they give the presidential speeches, and he had this map of Central America up, and it was all the red wave was coming through Central America, and I remember, so I was 16 years old at the time, and I remember very distinctly sitting there and watching that speech, you know, and being very compelled by it, and essentially believing what I was hearing and thinking that, well, yes, indeed, there's a great concern in this place called Central America, which, you know, is somewhere south of here. You know, and so I guess my parents were opposed to the Vietnam War, so I guess that probably had some kind of influence on me by osmosis. But it wasn't really until I went out to college in Seattle, Washington, Tacoma, Washington, actually, a little liberal arts school out there, Pacific Lutheran University. And there, you know, I came into contact with a couple professors, and especially some fellow students who were very politically active. And the professors in particular took an interest in me, and something that I'll, you know, be ever forever grateful for, that sort of investment that they of time and that they were willing to put in with me. A history professor by the name of Jack Birmingham and a anthropology professor by the name of Greg Goulden. And you know, and it kind of as a consequence of their influence and the influence of fellow students, you know, I sort of came to discover that what I had heard back in 1984 was not particularly accurate, and to say the least. And that was kind of the ongoing process by which I became very, very committed to trying to figure out what was going on in Central America and what was an appropriate sort of U.S. policy response. And so even though my initial interest in the subject matter was sort of through a U.S. foreign policy approach, you know, I came to realize that what really needed to be done sort of to determine if U.S. policy in this place where I've been born and raised, the United States, was doing the right thing was to look more deeply into the local situation and to find out the story there and the history there and the experience there. And that is ultimately what led me to decide to go to graduate school in Latin American history. And then of the three or four options I had in terms of acceptances, I decided to go down to UC Santa Barbara, in part because the one Salvadoran who had a PhD in history at the time was teaching there at the time, Hector Lindo Fuentes. And so I was sort of interested in working with him and under him. And he eventually left not too long after I got there to go teach at Fordham, where he is now. And he and I have co-authored a couple of books together since then.
Interesting.
And after he left, I was picked up by an Argentinianist, a scholar by the name of David Rock, who very generously picked me up and shepherded me through the remaining process and finished my PhD there. But ultimately, that's how I came around to focusing on Central America and more specifically studying El Salvador. And maybe with one quick little anecdote about El Salvador, I have another distinct recollection.
Sure.
Of sitting on the floor of the open stacks of the UCSB library, and, you know, speaking to the power of open stacks and the importance that it is in our lives. I remember pulling a book off the shelf at the time called Miguel Marmol by Roque Dalton, and just being completely captivated by this story. Dalton's a longtime political activist in El Salvador who was assassinated in 1975.
Right.
You know, he wrote this testimonial or recorded this testimonial by this communist activist from the 1930s who survived the 1932 repression and went on to be a ranking figure in the party for many years. But this story and the power of this just really had a impact on me. So all that convergence of forces led me to put together a proposal, a pre-dissertation proposal to head down to El Salvador in 1993, or, you know, 1 year after the war was over, and to see what the archives had to offer around some of these kind of historic questions here.
Right. So in your research in this book, you're looking at the period from about 1880 to the 1932 revolt and repression. Mm-hmm. And you're talking mostly about the systems of the political system that had emerged in El Salvador at that time and how it sort of led up to the authoritarian government that lasted through most of the 20th century. But I was wondering if you could just explain a little bit about El Salvador itself, you know, what the sort of setting is for the events that you're talking about, for the kind of this political system that emerges in El Salvador, what it, what kind of geography it's coming out of, what kind of economic situation, and a little bit about what kinds of information then you were able to find from El Salvador that allowed you to write the book.
Sure. On the one hand, El Salvador is a prototypical case study, if we can put it in terms like that, of, or at least is representative of the broader Latin American experience in many ways. But at the same time, it also has a lot of peculiarities that, that make it a very distinct country and sort of set it apart. One thing that sets it apart is its small size. You know, really the smallest country outside of the Caribbean, in Latin America. Another one is that, how dependent it became on one particular, crop, in this case, coffee, such that by on the eve of the Great Depression, something like 90% of El Salvador's export revenues are derived from coffee.
Right.
So it has a very deeply monocrop, economy. The other things that kind of set it apart are that in 1932, there occurred this, horrible event, but, you know, in response to a relatively small peasant uprising, or perhaps I should say a reasonably sized peasant uprising that ultimately sort of attacked about a dozen villages in western El Salvador, the government at the time and the military regime at the time just unleashed this wave of terror across the western countryside and ended up murdering, you know, massacring an untold number of people. You know, we've oftentimes said it was 30,000. But whether it was many thousands of 10,000 or more or whatever, but it's probably one of the worst single episodes of state repression by a government in, you know, modern Latin American history in terms of that many thousands of people dying within the span of about, you know, 10 days or 2 weeks time.
Wow.
And then, from that point thereafter, El Salvador has the dubious distinction of having the sort of longest run of uninterrupted military rule. So from 1931, right before that event in 1932, until 1979, and really, to be realistically speaking, I mean, the military had tremendous influence and power up until the end of the Civil War in 92, but in terms of kind of officially a military government in power, you know, it was almost, so from 31 to 71, almost five decades of uninterrupted rule. And that is in a region of the world that has had a lot of, uninterrupted military rule. That's the longest. And then finally, you know, the distinct quality is that while many countries in Latin America had brutal civil conflicts in the 60s, 70s or 80s, the Salvadoran one was one of the worst, in the sense that just in per capita consequences of human life, especially during the first 3 years of the war, professor of political science, Terry Lynn Carl, who's been doing some, who's been playing an important role in bringing some of the, generals to trial, some of the army officers to trial. She has a little diagram that demonstrates that El Salvador civil war in the first 3 years in particular may have been the most, costly in terms of per capita of human life of all the civil conflicts in Central America. So all of these things sort of make El Salvador a particularly intense and particularly distinct kind of case.
It's in many ways like
go ahead.
It's in many ways, it seems like the similar experience to many other countries in the region, but taken to extremes.
Or at least with its own peculiarities, yeah. And I guess then the follow-up question you have is sort of how I came to this particular subject, right? Or how the materials that I found allowed me to work on this.
Right.
Yeah. When I went down in 93 to the first time and went to the archives, it was kind of a matter of sort of finding. I knew I had an interest in these issues, historically situated, the 1932 uprising and the origin of the military regimes. And indeed, that's, you know, where the title of this particular book comes from. So I guess we could have mentioned earlier that this book, even though it's published here in 2013, you know, it was my dissertation that I finished back in 1997. and I got sidetracked by a lot of other stuff in the past 16, 17 years. And so this is, it's curious that it's like kind of in the mid stage of my career, but it was, you know, really a project that has been around with me for a long time and has been interrupted by some other projects in between. But, anyway, so when I was there in 1993 and I went into the archives and, briefly, not to draw this out too much, but, cause the archives kind of are an interesting part of this story to the extent that they, you know, really dictate what's possibly done.
Right.
But the archives are housed in the National Palace building in downtown San Salvador, in central San Salvador. And when I got there in 93, you know, they had the earthquake in 86 and lots of, you know, large areas of central San Salvador were still, they look like a war zone. And of course, you know, the war had only been over for a year. But the National Palace was a shell of a building. It was a really, it was a hard place to work in. And, you know, like there were no windows in it. It's got all this traffic going around outside of it. And there's really one functioning bathroom. And I sometimes have made the joke to people that if the archival staff guarded their bathroom more than they guarded their documents. When I went back for the full-time research the following year, you know, it took them about 2 days before they got kind of tired of me constantly asking for stuff and essentially said, here, just go get the documents yourself. You can kind of essentially have unlimited access to the documents. But it took about 2 months before they let me use their bathroom. So, kind of a funny side note there. And that's not meant to say that the archival staff was not, really good and very professional, but it's just sort of a funny commentary on the state of the affairs.
And their situation is understandable, yeah.
Pardon?
Their situation is understandable, yeah.
Yeah. But the archive itself, I mean, another Salvadoran scholar by the name of Aldo Laudia had gone down actually while the war was still going on. He was the first one to get into the archives, and he had done a tremendous job of working with archival staff and bringing documents in from other archives and this type of stuff and getting some stuff in boxes. But, I mean, basically the archives was in a state of real, it was a mess. And, you know, when I got there, especially 93, I mean, there were just piles of documents literally in corners, you know, next to open windows and, you know, they were getting wet and they were totally dusty and they were decaying and all this stuff. And even the main documents that I ended up being interested in because they had, all of the stuff relating to political correspondence, which is the archive of the collection of the Ministerio de Gobernación, or the Ministry of Government, or the Ministry of the Interior, however you want to pronounce it. I mean, as I, you know, indicate my introduction there, you know, Aldo and the staff had got those, you know, at least by year and into boxes. And so, there were about 500 of these archival boxes and another couple hundreds worth of bundles. But, you know, this stuff was not organized or cataloged in any way, shape, or form. And so, you know, if you want to go through and do what I was trying to do, which is a fairly comprehensive look at the archive to sort of see what this archival repository has to say to you, the only way to do it was just to sit there and go box by box, page by page, and just flip and flip and flip and just, you know, and this was before the age of digital camera, so I ended up sitting there with a photocopier and, you know, just like photocopying each of these things as they went along. And, you know, the only way that was going to be possible was then to essentially have unlimited access and essentially just to sit there for, you know, a year or more, and then just, you know, flip through and just work your way through it. And so, but ultimately it was the existence of that, you know, Gobernación records, which essentially consists of the correspondence back and forth between the national, departmental, and municipal levels that, you know, forms the backbone of this, of this particular study. And maybe I'll just mention one more thing about archives that, that reflect what's contained in the study. I also went to archives in D.C. and Washington, D.C., and I went to some variety of municipal archives also. I traveled out from the capital at various times, but I went to D.C. and I went to London. But the really kind of exciting find in terms of, you know, not doing historical research is rarely exciting, but I did end up going to Moscow in 94, you know, just a few years after the fall of the Soviet Union, shortly after they sort of opened up their archives. And I was curious as to, well, just what might happen to be here in Moscow, you know, in relationship to the Communist Party of El Salvador in the 30s and whatever else. And I really had no idea what I was going to be getting into, if I was going to find anything. But, you know, sure enough, I managed to get there, and I managed to get, you know, into the archive. And I got someone, there's a very helpful archivist there. She probably doesn't work there anymore, but she spoke Spanish as well as Russian, so I was able to communicate in Spanish. And then get these records delivered. And according to the records log, basically no one else had ever looked at these things. Maybe one Soviet general, for whatever reason, had gone back in and looked at these things. But, you know, so she kind of pulls these things out, you know, you flip into it, and you're just sort of like, well, I wonder what this is. And it's like, you know, you just, that moment where that light bulb goes on and that your jaw drops, you know, like, oh my gosh, this is the correspondence between the Salvadoran Communist Party and the Comintern, you know, or the Bureau of the Caribbean here in New York. And it's like, nothing like this exists in El Salvador, and no one's ever seen this before, and I wonder what's in here. And then, within just minutes, you know, it seemed to me that it was like, provides a completely, you know, revisionist interpretation of what happened in the 1932 uprising. Oh my gosh, that sort of moment. So that was the other kind of archival story that then, you know, merged in with my time in El Salvador.
So we will get to that particular story a little bit later. But the thing I want to ask you now is, so in these government correspondence between the central government in San Salvador and these sort of departmental governments and party politicians, what you find is the records of what you call a system of patronage, also of clientelism between elites and peasants, but in this case specifically this sort of system of political patronage, networks of bosses and subordinates who are sort of negotiating political power in competition with each other across the country from really the late mid-19th century up through to the 1920s. And so I was wondering if you could just talk about, you know, what is this system of patronage and what is its, you know, importance to then the history of El Salvador from the late 1920s onwards?
Yeah, so, you know, basically when I sort of dove into the records, I was just essentially pulling out any piece of paper that seemed to relate to politics or elections. Of course, I was particularly interested in any social movements or uprisings or anything like this. What, you know, sort of, you might say, sort of bled out of the archives, kind of came before me as I was pulling all this stuff out, was just a tremendous amount of correspondence relating to elections and political activities related to the placement of municipal mayors and departmental governors and then all the way up to the national presidential level. And, you know, the things that jumped out at me were just how tremendously active this electoral process was, you know, historically, like year after year, time after time. Just a lot of elections were being held. And while you always have to, of course, read these sources with a critical eye and a jaundiced eye,
right,
you know, thinking, you know, in the back of my mind, well, these are just, you know, elite-led, you know, shenanigans regarding electoral activities. You know, even with the most critical interpretive eye, you realize that you know, throughout these, you know, many, many decades of time, you know, dating all the way back to, you know, the moment that El Salvador became independent. You know, quickly, I should, you know, interlude here that one of the big problems we have in El Salvador in terms of 19th century history is that the archive burned down in 1889, taking with it, you know, untold, you know, volumes of 19th century and probably colonial correspondence or colonial documentation. So one of the exciting finds that I found, you know, was actually out in a municipal archive in Sonsonate that had, the west of El Salvador that had, obviously survived and not burned down. And they had, political activities and electoral activities, records relating to that going all the way back to right when El Salvador became independent. So it was those types of things that I was able to go out and find. And then look at the patterns of politics and elections, you know, over time and sort of see what was going on, in the process. And so one of the ways I've kind of described this to myself and maybe to others on occasion is that this is, you know, an excavation of the endoskeleton of Salvadoran politics, because the nature of the documentation in El Salvador and the nature of the documentation that I was working with in particular, it doesn't allow us to invest or to discover too much about the sort of hopes and dreams of the individuals involved and their peculiar and distinct personalities and or necessarily what they thought, per se. We don't have diaries. We don't have hardly any personal correspondence for these people. These types of collections don't exist. But, you know, we have this vast volume of kind of a vapor trail or a paper trail, you might say, of the things they were doing as they were engaging in politics and in particular elections.
Right.
And so then, you know, what I ended up doing was just, you know, kind of systematically going through this year after year and trying to figure out how did this thing function? What was the structure of this over time? And so, right, so as you say there, what I eventually sort of concluded or found was a tremendously vigorous electoral experience going on over the span of, you know, 100 years from, you know, as early as 1840s and 1830s, right up into the, you know, 1940s. And then since then, I've looked, you know, at the time period after 1940 and found it to be very continuous to this. But at least within that 100-year span, you know, there were a lot of elections going on. Nobody ever held office without holding an election, even if it was preceded by a coup. And there was a lot of active participation by the broader whole of the population. But as you point out, and as the main sort of argument of the book in regard to how this is going on, these were very controlled elections within the context of them taking place within these patronage networks. So I was certainly influenced in my reading of these things by that great book on Brazil by Richard Graham. The specific title escapes me, Patronage and Power and Patronage and Politics in 19th Century Brazil. There it is on my shelf. I see it right there. You know, but showing that what was in competition were these networks of patronage and patron-client relations, and that what kind of defined El Salvador through the 19th century until the state really began to centralize in the latter part of the 19th century was just the decentralized presence of these things, these highly competitive but decentralized entities, and how people were different networks were desperately competing for the things they needed to succeed in politics. So that could be people's votes, it could be, you know, physical material, horses and bullets and money and that type of thing, and food to either, you know, make war with one another or whatever else, but to marshal and to mobilize these precious resources to succeed in the realm of politics in one way, shape, or form.
One example I thought that was pretty interesting, an illustration that you gave that I thought was interesting was early on you mentioned one particular election where on the national level the election seems competitive, but then when you looked at the individual departments, you found almost unanimous voting by department or by subdivisions of departments for one candidate.
Yeah, or even even by municipality. I think you might be referring to the 1895 election, as a metaphor, just because the documentation is so rich for that. So I sort of put that up front and say, okay, here's this really rich example that we have, and I'm going to contend that this is typical of what's going to take place elsewhere. But yeah, on that election, you know, two guys are running against one another for the vice presidency and just happens to be the case. And when the aggregate results, you know, it looks like a really competitive election, and it was. You know, the voting was pretty close, and one guy kind of won by a relatively narrow margin. But then as soon as you get down into the deep part of the data, you know, the disaggregate, and you go like township by township, you realize that the voting in almost every one of those townships was unanimous or near unanimous. And what's also quite interesting is that in some places, like you have a particular department, and you take one portion of this department, and you might have, you know, 10 out of 14 municipalities will be unanimous for one of the candidates. But then somehow or another, the other candidate has patronage ties, managed to sort of win over or form alliances with local political leaders in, say, the four other municipalities. And so even though they might just be like a couple kilometers down the road from these other places, the voting results are exactly 100% unanimous for the other guy.
Right.
And so, yeah, that type of constant jockeying for patronage alliances and the construction of patron-client relations like that, you know, that's my basic contention, is that that was going on constantly throughout the 19th and into the 20th century, and that ultimately then the military authoritarian state that's constructed in El Salvador after 1931 is an outgrowth of that. And it doesn't break from that pattern. It's just a kind of evolution of that. And so that's, as we get towards the end of the book, that's kind of the claim, is this argument of continuity and how this experience in the 19th and early 20th century fed into the 50 years of military authoritarian rule.
Right. But this raises sort of an interesting question, which you do answer, but it's interesting. You know, the thing that pops into my mind when I was reading the book was, if these elections are going on, lots of elections, constant elections, and lots of heartfelt rhetoric about democracy and about suffrage. And as you point out, these elections are going on, including immediately after coups. There are also lots of coups, lots and lots of coups. So what is the purpose of having so many of these elections? Because they're not exactly preventing violent overthrow of existing governments in many cases. What is sort of their function for the political elites that are involved in the patronage systems controlling these elections? What do they do for them?
Yeah, I think, well, in the most immediate sense, just a very practical sense, right? Obviously, the point here is who's going to be in office and who's going to have the power of office holding to exercise whatever privileges that carries with it, whether it's setting tax policy or making war or whatever else. So obviously, like any election, that has the outcome. But I think you're right to pose the question of what's really curious and represents another kind of particularity that I was working on in the book, was this tremendous paradox between language and the praxis of elections. So we know these elections are not democratic as by whatever standard of measure we want to use. But there's a lot of them. People are tremendously active and involved. And along with that, you have, along with them, a constant and ever-present and almost language of democracy, of republicanism, of the promotion of free suffrage, of the promotion of individual rights, unyielding in that sense. And so it's a kind of a Gordian knot that I'm not really able to untie, but I'm able to document that you've got these two things going side by side. And so to get back then directly to the question that you asked, it would certainly seem to be that what you've got here is, you know, this construction of the notion of the nation state and of national identity, and even around ideas of modernity and progress and so on and so forth, that, you know, we are democratic, we hold elections, we, you know, live by the rules that we've set down in the Constitution, these formal rules, but we do so with these very informal practices that, on the one hand, are never talked about explicitly in any of the documentation. No one ever says, like, you know, I know we're just saying democracy over here, but what we really mean, of course, is that we're going to go over and steal this election or something like this. But it's just this, it's a maintenance, this consistency with which you've got these informal practices alongside these formal practices and this language of democracy alongside this practice of what, you know, I call authoritarianism. And so it would seem that, you know, the answer to your question is that this is part of what is, you know, the making of the identity of this political world that we have there in El Salvador. And so what I'm trying to sort of suggest sort of long term down the way is that to the extent that this functions so consistently over the span of, say, 100 years and into the military regime, and then I'm able to document, I think at least, that the military regimes pick this exact same thing up, a language of democratization, even a language eventually of social reform and of the responsibility of the state to look out for its citizenry, alongside these very authoritarian electoral and political practices, that in some way, shape, or form, you know, you're constructing a culture, a political culture, you're constructing a social arena in which the language, the word democracy and everything that associates with it, at some level in people's minds has to be associated with these other practices over here in
right.
some way, shape, or form. And at least in somehow must help us to explain why El Salvador has had such challenges in creating and implementing a democracy, which, you know, briefly, if I was actually to go back and say one of the other things that kind of is interesting about El Salvador and sets it apart from
sure.
many of the other countries in Latin America is that, you know, almost anywhere else you can find at least a moment where you've got call it a reformist government, a democratic government, even a left-leaning socialist government. Every other country in Latin America basically seems to have had at least some moment where this occurred. And in El Salvador, there was a tiny little window of a moment in the, you know, late 1930s, or excuse me, 1931,
yeah.
very late 1920s. But, you know, that's it. And so the kind of dominance of these authoritarian political practices is almost unique to El Salvador. And so maybe at some level, this paradox, this dichotomy between this language on the one side and these practices on the other, helps us to explain that.
One thing that you mention is as part of a reason for this, not the whole explanation by any means, but one factor that plays into this persistent authoritarian system of governance that is sort of wrapped in democracy is the relationship between the elites and the peasantry in El Salvador, and especially between the Ladinos and Indians, which is a kind of a unique relationship in El Salvador relative to that same dynamic in some of the neighboring countries. I wonder if you could just talk a little bit about what is sort of the relationship in the late 19th century in these political systems between, for one, elites and peasants, and two, particularly how the indigenous population is sort of relating to this.
Sure. One of the things that it also seems to make El Salvador kind of a curious case study is that when I've looked at research done on other countries, and I think Colombia and Mexico are a couple that stand out in particular, when you look at the political world of those places in the 19th century and in the mid-19th century, you find a moment or an era or a phase where the masses, the peasantry, call it what you will, the plebeian society finds a space to inject itself into the political arena in a pretty autonomous way. And I'm thinking here of the work of James Sanders on Colombia and Peter Guardino on Mexico. And, but, you know, they document pretty specifically where these mass actors sort of give new meaning to the definition of civic republicanism,
right.
and they start to inject that into the system. And that generates typically a response back by elite actors who fear that and believe that they may have been responsible for creating the opening, or at least tolerated the opening, and they're anxious to close that back down. And so they document these moments where then whatever opening may have existed gets closed back down. Well, in the case of El Salvador, I mean, and it could be my own limitations, it could be the curious limitations of Salvadoran archival resources, but that moment never seems to really exist, at least comparable to that, where you've got this kind of redefinition of civic republicanism and the peasantry stepping in to kind of autonomously redefine the meaning of politics and civic life. And so something that's curious about El Salvador is that when you look at the formal rules, there's never a backtrack on advancing participation in the electoral system. Every constitution that comes along is more progressive in terms of granting and permitting access of actors into the political arena. It's a constant step forward, if you want to put it in those terms, never backward, to the point that by the mid-1880s, you know, if you are an 18-year-old male, regardless of property, regardless of ethnicity, you know, you've got the right to vote and participate in the political system.
Wow.
And so it struck me and seemed kind of comparable to the work on Peru in the early 20th century by Cecilia Mendez, who talked about how in response to an uprising there in the early parts of the 19th century, the response by elites, instead of trying to crush that and destroy that and stop that, which of course is what they wanted to do, but what they were most interested in was realizing the potential of active, electorally involved, politically active mass actors, and,
right.
and they wanted to encourage them into the system, control them, use them, whatever, but at least have them present, because that's part of this notion of making this nation state and the political structure around it. And so that, you know, in response to your question, seems to be something similar to what was going on in El Salvador. Of course, as I, you know, accept and show, there's plenty of very class-based, material-based, hierarchically rooted, relationships between elite actors who want to control the system and want to march mass actors and laborers and into the political arena and control them. But, you know, there's also this curious dynamic where you've got a very, seemingly very active mass electoral audience that is not exactly rebelling against the system, but is participating in it in a not entirely autonomous way, but not either a particularly, you know, controlled or manipulated sort of way. And that's what I think ultimately sort of feeds into, as you say, from the late 19th century and then into the early 20th century and ultimately into the 1932 rebellion. One component of that is that you've got these pockets of, at that time, the early 20th century of highly indigenous areas.
Right.
And so beyond just the peasant to elite relationship on a non-ethnic level, you get into those areas and then you've got, you know, pretty autonomous Indian communities, indigenous communities on large tracts of communal land who are then being confronted, who happen to be on land that has incredible value as potential coffee land. Which is, you know, an old story in Latin America, and now they're beginning to confront the onslaught of the state and the onslaught of Ladino or non-Indian. We almost can't call them elites yet, but, you know, you might say wannabe elites coming into the area and targeting them and their land for transformation into coffee land.
And they are sort of unevenly beginning to participate in the same system of clientelism as Ladinos were of roughly the same sort of situation in terms of class or in terms of their economic role, but they aren't quite at this point, they aren't quite part of the system in the same way.
Right. And what I don't have the evidence as to what I'm about to say and what you're referring to is not overwhelming. We don't have a lot of case studies, but the couple of case studies that I do have, municipalities in the West and in highly indigenous areas, you know, are pretty revealing. And what you're referring to is when you look at these two towns, Nahuizalco was one, for instance, a well-known indigenous community out in the West and another one, but I'll just focus on Nahuizalco. You have a overwhelmingly large, majority Indian population or indigenous population in that town, something like 90%. And they're very actively involved politically. And when they are confronted with this new and emergent Ladino elite, you know, the Ladino elites would behave exactly like you would expect that they would in the face of an overwhelming majority Indian population. They're patron-client relations with one another, and they're trying to co-opt a few of the Indians if they can, but ultimately they're trying to use very controlled elections to make sure that Ladinos are in power. And one of the things that I say that the documents demonstrate is that when the tables are turned and the indigenous folks are participating in the electoral arena against those Ladinos, when they have the overwhelming majority and they're going to win the election no matter what, they participate in that electoral arena in exactly the same way, with unanimous voting, with the same language of democratization, of accusing the other side of not being democratic and then practicing these non-democratic practices. And if the notion is that mass actors are going to be promoting democracy to defend their class interests against elites, in this case ethnically differential elites, that's not how they're acting. And so that's where I sort of make that claim. It's a modest claim, but the evidence, you know, is what leads me to it, is that, you know, these mass actors were at least somehow participatory in constructing this long-term pattern of authoritarian rule in El Salvador.
Okay. As far as the pattern of authoritarian rule in El Salvador develops and changes, to move a little bit forward in the future, you talk about in the 19-teens, the government of two guys, Melendez and Quiñones, beginning in 1913, which you describe as the expansion there of the patronage system to the national level, sort of at last. Because I guess before you've been dealing with patronage networks, as you call them, that are a kind of jockeying for position between different departments, and they're staging coups against each other. And it's in the 19-teens, where you get the formation of the PND, the Partido Nacional Democrático, that is, as you put it, the national level patronage network. I wonder if you could just talk a little bit about that and how it formed and functioned.
Yeah, so that represents the kind of turning point of the centralization of El Salvador's authoritarian political system, where right prior to this, what you had were regional patronage networks, and they were constantly in conflict with one another, and they were trying to reach into one another's geographic and demographic space, you might say, and pluck out, you know, get some of the periphery away from their adversaries and create alliances with them. And everybody was trying to create a large enough and powerful enough network that they eventually could, you know, hold office, you know, sort of in perpetuity, you might say. But it proved to be impossible up until that point. And so what the Melendez-Quiñones dynasty, as it's called, or this 13-year rule by this family represents is, you know, the kind of final consolidation in which finally this one network under these two brothers and brother-in-law were able to do was to finally take advantage of the economic growth of coffee and the centralization of the state and the, you know, the kind of nationalization of the military and finally hold and consolidate power. And that's what they represented. And then that, you know, leads us into this next, you know, fascinating moment, which, you know, we'll talk about here, I'm sure, in just a minute, where you've got one of their insiders comes to power next, and for reasons that still remain unclear to me, frankly, but, you know, he engages in what can only be described as genuine democratic reform and sort of takes this system and begins to turn it on its head. But before we get to that point, you know, the one other thing that's interesting about the Melendez-Quiñones era is that you don't have regional patronage networks essentially battling for control of the central state like you saw up through the 19th century, but you certainly have a lot of infighting within this one network.
Right.
And so, you know, you've got, players that are deeply enmeshed in this state that they've created, and inside their political system, and sometimes are personal friends, sometimes are even intermarried by family, but they're jockeying for position inside of this, and sometimes, you know, trying to pull support away from those particular individuals. And so one of the things that Melendez and Quiñones had a difficult time with was the relationship with the military, and that the military and certain military leaders seem to be loyal to other potentially aspiring political players within the system. And so one of the things that they ended up doing was creating what can only be described as a paramilitary organization, to serve as kind of the hitmen for their political regime. And that was called the Red League, or the Liga Roja. And, you know, there's a little bit of a kind of debate amongst the Salvadoranists as to what this thing represents, because there are some who contend that, you know, the rank and file of this were, of course, poor peasants, largely from rural areas. And there's a contention that this Liga Roja represented a kind of early, autonomy by mass actors or plebeian actors, that they were taking this Liga Roja and kind of turning it into their own, autonomous base for advancing their particular interests, you know, presumably their material and class-based interests. And I'm certainly sympathetic to that possibility happening, but it just seems to me that all the evidence that I read really points to this as being, you know, much more of, a kind of classic armed wing of a patronage network who was battling against another armed wing. It just happened to be inside the same patronage network, right, and happened to be the national military, or police. And so the Melendez-Quinones was trying to, you know, use this. And when they eventually dismantled the Liga Roja, I contend it was not because that they were worried about peasant mass action, but that some of the local elite actors who were in charge of these local Liga Rojas were actually using them to advance their personal political aspirations back against the Melendez-Quinones regime. And so when in deconstructing this thing, they were actually, what I say is, kind of closing this patronage valve that they had unintentionally opened up. But that reflects, you know, the kind of broader debate we're having about the meaning of democracy and authoritarianism in El Salvador. So the Liga Roja is just sort of one, relatively small but interesting window into that debate.
Right. So following this establishment of a national level regime, as you talk about, after Quinones leaves office, he's replaced by, as you said, an insider who engages in a surprising and rather sudden movement towards reform. So can you tell us a little bit about Bosque?
Yeah, Pedro Romero Bosque, he was the vice president and the former minister of war, former chief justice of the Supreme Court, had been, you know, a deep political insider for years and years, wasn't an overwhelmingly wealthy man, but, you know, certainly had substantial resources, but, you know, was more of like a career political high-level bureaucrat. So for a variety of reasons, when it came into the 1927, the Melendez-Quinones regime, which would have rather sort of kept it amongst itself and its close family members, for a variety of reasons that we don't have to go into now, had to go to a quote-unquote outsider, but they went to this deep insider. And so they oversaw the election of this guy, and sure enough, he won in the standard fashion. You know, it was a completely unanimous result. And he became president, and almost as soon as he became president, he began to both talk about democracy in a way that was strange relative to how it had been in the past, or at least it sounded exactly the same. Democracy meant free suffrage and individual rights and all this stuff, which had been said many, many times over. But when it got down to the point of what he actually sort of meant as to how that was going to look on any given day of the election, it was different. And so it was a very fascinating experience and there are a lot of records in the 1920s, so that's one advantage we have there. Tremendous amounts of telegrams of correspondence back and forth between the local and national level. But yeah, what you realize very quickly is that, at least according to the documentation, it's like this really appears to have been, and this is not to disempower mass actors out there who may have deeply wanted democracy. And in fact, Hector Lindo Fuentes might be working on a project that will prove what I'm about to say wrong. And if so, more power to him. But that at least the records that I'm seeing there really show that you know, this seems to have really been the kind of brainchild of him and a couple of very high-ranking ministers around him. And what they began to do was sort of send out these telegram missives out into where voting actually takes place, out in the municipalities, that says that this is what election day needs to look like. And that then generated these responses back from people who, you know, were essentially the equivalent of people scratching their heads saying, "What do you mean by that? Because that's not what you know, this political language that we've used for a very long time looks like on the ground here. So I'm confused by this, and, you know, sort of why are you doing this, and what is it that you, you know, really want out of this? So it's this kind of wonderful moment from a archival perspective where the documentation sort of shows this system. It both exposes the way the system was working before and then how the people who were practicing it were responding to a sort of new set of rules and a changing of the meaning of the language. So I found that kind of fascinating. But, you know, why he did this is I don't think the documentation, at least that I saw, really helps us to understand. I could have gone into some broader series of case studies to try to explain that, but it really wasn't the kind of objective I was after. But it was just to show that indeed there was this moment of attempted and energetic democratic reform that had, in a 4-year span, very, very mixed results. On the one hand, I show with, I think, some pretty compelling documentation that not a lot ultimately really changed out there in the municipalities. In most cases, the same people that had been in power for many years out there remained in power. But that he did manage ultimately to put in some sort of administrative and bureaucratic structures that allowed for a relatively free, it's often called, you know, the first free and fair election in Salvadoran history in 1931, that indeed did put this, you know, at least he was a very wealthy landowner, but had spent some time in England and had become a fan of the Labour Party and actually ran on the created the Labour Party in El Salvador. This guy named Arturo Araujo. And he won, and it seemed that, you know, he did have some intentions of overseeing some progressive reforms. He was only in office for 8 months before the military took over. So.
Just to say, like, that election in 1931 is really fascinating as you describe it, because in addition to Araujo, who is, you know, he attempted a coup in 1920 as, I think, his previous political, moment, and he's the head of this Labor Party. Another competitor in the election is, Molina, Tomas Molina, who is he had been Quiñones, he's a relative of Quiñones, who had challenged him in 1922, and whose supporters had actually been massacred by, the forces of the national government.
The Liga Roja was supposedly one of the key instigators of that massacre in 22, and so it reinforces don't lose your train of thought there, but it reinforces what I was saying, where you've got this Molina, this very, very close insider who presents a challenge to the regime, and the regime, and was gaining ground in the military, and the regime turns around and uses this paramilitary force and crushes it. So, but anyway, go ahead.
And so now he and these figures are being allowed, and they're actively participating in a real electoral challenge for the first time. This is just like such a striking moment that this is happening here, you know, not even a decade after those previous events had been going on. So,
and it's pretty interesting to watch how you know, Romero Bosque, again, his motivation behind this, I wasn't able to really understand, frankly, you know, based on what I had, but what he did is fairly evident, you know, and he was very effective at aligning himself with the military, at not alienating them, and using the powers that he and some ministers around him had to sort of really try to not rewrite the rules. He was operating within the existing formal rules, which look very democratic, but kind of give new meaning to this, the informal practices. And being able to watch that unfold, you know, in the documentation sort of day to day, month to month, year to year during his presidency. It was quite fascinating. And then to end up in this, you know, relatively open election in 1931. It was a very interesting thing to watch.
So, talk about what happens to Araujo in 1931 and, the guy who replaces him, Martinez.
Well, yeah, this is, you know, the kind of, iconic moment in the sort of sad story of authoritarianism in El Salvador, but as you know, many people know, in December of 31, you know, there's a military coup. This thing is different than all of the other coups. There'd been lots of officers in power, but it had kind of happened it was a sort of spear point, you might say, of these kind of rival patronage networks. But
right.
It's different. Now the military is kind of a sort of formalized institution of the state. And, you know, and these officers, I mean, I'm sure, of course, we don't know exactly yet, you know, made some alliances with powerful private sector actors and stuff like this. I mean, it's not really clear how that happened, but yeah, they basically roll in over the issue of military pay and the kind of grinding, incapacities of the Araujo regime in the middle of the Great Depression and take over power. And eventually then the vice president of the time, this guy, Maximiliano Hernandez Martinez, right, eventually sort of gets his way, into power there. And, you know, as I try to show, I certainly argue that there's this consistent culture and practice of authoritarianism that could have predicted 5 years of uninterrupted military rule. Mm-hmm. But, you know, at that particular moment, there's not anything to say that, you know, Hernandez Martinez was going to make it. He was in a, you know, terrible state of affairs.
Right.
The U.S. was opposing him. The economy was in crisis. He had no political base. There's all kinds of reasons why he should ultimately have failed. But it seems to me that, you know, the episode of 1932, the rise of the peasantry and the crackdown that went with it, you know, went a long ways towards consolidating his power. And then his ability to then, you might say, implant himself upon this long-standing system of centralized patronage and clientelism. So he just was able to essentially not so much appropriate, but integrate himself into this.
Right.
Helps to explain first his longevity and then ultimately the continuation of military rule thereafter.
So, in 1932, there is this peasant uprising, which is brutally repressed by the government. And you make a particular sort of argument about the origins of that uprising, which has often been the Communist Party in El Salvador at the time does play a role in what's going on. But you make an argument about its role and about how that's been understood. So I guess, could you just explain a little bit about what happens during this uprising and what you think is actually distinctive about it that differs in a bit from what other people have argued about the uprising?
Sure. So the uprising itself involves about a dozen communities out in Western El Salvador, and most of the communities that are involved here are disproportionately indigenous, like Nahuizalco, 90% indigenous,
right.
Izalco, Waiúa, Tacuba, and a couple of the other larger departmental capitals, Sonsonate and Ahuachapán, are also involved or attacked. And so, on the one hand, the uprising is just a rising up of these folks, whoever they are and were, and they occupy the municipalities. They attempt to occupy Ahuachapán and Sonsonate, the two larger departmental capitals, but their attempts to attack the garrison or the forts, the cuartels there, they're repulsed and pushed back from those particular areas. But they do manage to take control of about a half a dozen, smaller, but nonetheless important regional municipalities out there. And they hold on to them for the longest is about 3 days. And there's claims, and it seems to be somewhat accurate, that out in at least one of these, out in Tacuba in the far west, they may have actually even sort of created momentarily a Soviet, which would kind of seem to promote that the communist causality approach, interpretation of this. But anyway, and so they rise up, and we don't, to be honest, you know, we don't know a whole lot about exactly who these folks were, how this thing was organized, what exactly they were after. I mean, many of these most important questions remain highly elusive. to us. And frankly, at this point in the game, I don't think we'll ever know. I mean, I think that the closest chance we really had, given the documentation's inability to provide these answers, is when Jeff Gould, who's a professor at Indiana, a very, you know, well-known and senior professor at Indiana, and Aldo Laudia, who I mentioned previously, you know, teamed up and as part of a broader project in Central America, went out and conducted, you know, interviews with older folks and their family members, but in particular with older folks, you know, and were looking for people who could speak to what was this, you know, were you involved, and what was the cause of this, and how was this mobilized and organized? You know, and they came up with a wonderful book and some important contributions around there. But ultimately, you know, even they, after, you know, a couple hundred interviews, you know, had to accept that they weren't able to really find anybody who could say, yes, I was a militant in this uprising. This is what, you know, I did it for. This is how we organized and mobilized it. So these questions are largely lost to us, unfortunately, I think, at this point. But that being said, you know, what, sorry, and then maybe I'll just backtrack for a moment. So these folks who rose up and gained control of these roughly six municipalities and attacked approximately a dozen, they kind of caught the army, the military off guard and sort of had it on its heels waiting. That's why they're able to hold these cities for two or three days. But then the military managed to regroup. And this isn't the national military coming in from San Salvador yet. This is the local garrisons.
Right.
They regroup and they had overwhelming firepower and overwhelming speed and in a relatively short time, you know, once they started mobilizing within a span of about a day or so, you know, they had essentially kicked out the rebels, the insurgents from each of these municipalities. And so at that point, the rebellion is over. So two or three days. It's after that that the national government sends in all the reinforcements from the center and east of the country. And it's that arrival of this mass military force in conjunction with really angry locals who create paramilitary forces along with it,
right,
that over the next 10 days to 2 weeks, the killing takes place. And we have some pretty good insights into this, not nearly as much as we need to really understand it better, but we have some pretty, you know, compelling, dramatic stories of the massacre that occurred thereafter. And, you know, and it went on for about, you know, again, not very long in the big history of things, 10 days to 2 weeks, but, you know, thousands and thousands of people died in that process. And so coming out of that, then there's a variety of kind of arguments that I advanced, but just to get to the one that you're most focused on, which now has been kind of a debate that's been going on for, you know, it's now 16, 17 years that we Salvadorans have been kind of negotiating this, but in short, the kind of received wisdom when I came into it here was that the Communist Party and famed figures like Farabundo Martí were the principal actors or agents behind this uprising in 1932. And there's a, you know, wonderful book by Thomas Anderson back from the early 70s, you know, called Matanza. And I think his subtitle at the time was The Communist Rebellion of 1932 or something along those lines. And so mm-hmm. then there were a variety of other works that essentially kind of advanced this argument. And the National Archives on this, frankly, in El Salvador, they don't have a whole lot to offer on this. I mean, they certainly have some interesting pieces, but it really wasn't until I went to Moscow and really got my hands on those materials there that I began to advance what I would consider to be kind of a revisionist argument against this. And without going into it in too much detail, but, you know, this involves a correspondence between, not really with Moscow so much, but with the Caribbean Bureau in New York, but also with the Comintern in Moscow, and the local actors in El Salvador. Not a whole lot with Farabundo Martí, but some. But with the head of the Communist Party, the head of the International Red Aid, the head of the local labor union there, the FRTS. And, you know, so some really fascinating insights into what they're concerning themselves with, what their numbers are, what they're able to do and what are involved in. And in short, my interpretation of that was it just seemed really impossible for the Communist Party, which in January of 1932 was not even 2 years old, and, you know, at its maximum maybe had 500 members, a lot of whom seemed to me to be essentially located and rooted in the capital city of San Salvador.
Right.
To have had time or opportunity to have mobilized, you know, a movement of this scale that it is largely responsible for directing and guiding. And so it seemed to me that that the documentation indicates that we need to push back against that paradigm that, you know, we had up until that point about the role of the Communist Party and even the formalized left, and look deeper, even though we can't actually because the sources don't allow us to, but that we have to put the impetus for this back into the communities and back into the masses, largely indigenous masses, and whatever organizational structures that you know they have. And I tie that briefly back into the political realm because there certainly seems that there was a link between the rising success of Ladino, now relatively elite coffee growers who were taking political power away from these indigenous communities that for a long time had been competitive and active in local politics, and they were losing out at roughly the same time that these pressures were coming down, coming into 1932. And there's a couple very interesting documents that have local political indigenous actors, you know, writing to the departmental governor saying in so many words, you know, these Ladinos are stealing this election, you know, as they have before. And if you don't do something about this and come up here and help us in this process, you know, something bad is going to happen very, very quickly, that this mm-hmm. is spinning out of control. And then the next thing you know, the rebellion is taking place. And so that somehow that relationship between long-standing conflict or competition in the local political arena and this uprising, you know, at least somehow seems to be linked, which again would reinforce my slightly revisionist claim that I think we, you know, need to look back deeper into the local organizational structures for an explanation of this.
Right.
So again, unfortunately, I think that the sources really, we run into some brick walls there, some holes, you might say, but at least historiographically, that's the kind of debate we're involved in a little bit. In terms of understanding this potentially momentous event. But I think all of us who work on this and write on this, I think we all understand that regardless of who was behind it, you might say, who's the principal actor, what this certainly reveals to us is that, you know, these mass actors, you know, were present and involved and articulating what politics and what, you know, this nation state meant to them, and that they were, you know, involved in it, and that people had to engage them and address
right.
them at that level. And so I think that has long-term repercussions for the authoritarian system in El Salvador.
Right. We're almost out of time. What happens in the immediate aftermath, I guess, of the Martinez government specifically? How does that pass on to the continuation of military governance? If you could just talk very briefly about that.
Sure, yeah, very quickly. I think that then one of the things, and I think that this is where I've offered some of the more well-documented revisionist arguments about El Salvador and about the Martinez regime. But very briefly, you know, it's very clear that in the immediate aftermath of the massacre, you have this Martinez regime completely stepping back from that. You know, he pulled the troops out of the West. He put an end to the slaughter. And he began very quickly to be talking about, you know, the state's responsibility to help the poor against the rapacious rich landowners and land elite. I mean, he really began to sort of, I shouldn't say he really began, but he began to introduce the idea that the state is a reformist element that has an obligation to look out for its poor citizenry. And of course, this is just a tremendously traumatic paradox, given what the state just did to these folks, particularly out in the West. But I think that what the argument that you, you know, you kind of have to come to is that it was a very clear realization that the state was going to have to introduce, you know, along with this language of democracy and individual rights that it had had for decades, it was going to have to introduce the notion of social and economic reform as a part of that. And then what happens from that point forward is it's just a kind of constant evolution of debate inside these successive military regimes as to how much reform is going to be involved, how that's going to be presented, how those people who would be opposed to this, primarily, you know, very wealthy economic elites,
right,
are going to react to it, and how we can manage and balance that relationship. So in the case of Martinez, one of the things that he really did do or tried to fight was he tried to fight the coffee plantations from paying their workers in coupons instead of actual currency, and then having stores on the plantation that is the only place where those coupons could be used to buy goods. And so he was trying to end that system, and he ultimately failed. But what the documentation shows is that, you know, he actually, his regime actually went, you know, into, you know, fought the landowners on this. And also the documentation is pretty explicit that when, you know, indigenous peoples and indigenous communities came to him and came to the state asking for help relative to local elites and local Ladinos who they believed were, you know, repressing them and so forth, that he and his local military, you know, players out of the departments, you know, came to their aid and sided with them. So, you know, it's ironic. It's tremendously ironic, tremendously paradoxical. And maybe people that also study authoritarian systems, you know, recognize this as being, you know, maybe typical of it. But at least in the context of El Salvador, it sort of, you know, gives us a much more complex understanding of the Martinez regime. And then, to the extent that he seemed to set the standard for how military rule is going to take place after that, you know, not to be teleological about it, but it certainly seems to be consistently represented in the regimes that came after him.
Right.
And so one of the advantages I have in coming back and then publishing this study now in 2013 that, you know, was at least the initial draft was done 16 years earlier, that in the interim I've had the chance, you know, working with Hector Lindo and others to do some other scholarship on El Salvador after 1940. So that largely what took me so long to get back to this. And so, but it was advantageous for me because I was able to, to understand better what happened after Martinez and then to sort of draw out these legacies then in the epilogue and the conclusion to this.
Right. Well, I think we're just about out of time. Our classic last question for the New Books Network is, what are you working on next?
Yeah, well, I am just in the process of signing an advance contract for a project that I was actually working on when Scott Manwaring of Notre Dame came to me and asked me if I had any plans for this yet and if I'd consider it for UNC, and then I stopped this other project and then kind of finished the revisions on this one. But the other project that I'm working on now and hopefully we'll have the final draft done in spring is tentatively titled Remembering the Civil War in El Salvador, Memoir, Testimony, and the Narrative Battle. And what I'm looking at is memoirs and testimonies that have been produced in El Salvador since 1992 that focus on the Civil War and the memories of the Civil War. And so I'm trying to analyze through that particular source base how Salvadorans are remembering, collectively remembering the Civil War, and if there are any patterns that emerge out of those types of sources. And so what I'm working on is the revisions of that that manuscript.
Well, good luck, and I'll look forward to seeing
you. Thank you. Yeah, thanks very much.